from what's just been said, we get a sense that a crisis is beginning to unfold. And I think, Jenny, you have a specific question about the next phase in the events.
Yeah, it seemed like the Third Estate deputies seemed to have settled on a confrontation that would need a revolutionary change to resolve it. Why do you think this was?
It's really a process that occurs during these months. The Third Estate deputies obviously come along to the beginning of the Estates General in early May, brought in from the four corners of the country, in many cases men with no political experience. In some cases they have significant political experience, but it's more kind of administrative experience, of rural officials and so on. A lot of them are just small town lawyers, a few businessmen, property owners. They don't really know who they are collectively. But what then, of course, happens is that they are confronted by the resistance, particularly of the bishops and of the more conservative nobility, that block what those Third Estate deputies think of as perfectly reasonable requests to come together. You know, the Third Estate having been doubled, having got twice as many deputies, they think it perfectly reasonable they should all meet together. But that doesn't happen. And almost nothing happens, in fact, for weeks and weeks. And the Third Estate deputies are kind of forced to talk to each other, forced to discuss their political ideas. And as they do that, those of them that have got clearer political ideas, more radical ideas for how things should go, start to assume a kind of superiority over the others. And some of the deputies actually talk about this as a kind of educational process. They learn from those with more developed ideas about how to see this confrontation with the privileged orders that doesn't seem to have a resolution, and eventually bringing them round to the point of view that against this blatant, hostile, self-interested resistance, taking a big step forward, declaring themselves the National Assembly and trying to force a political solution is really the only thing that will work. So they become revolutionary, effectively, through this process of trying to deal with the situation they find themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Also, do you think the King really did intend to use the troops which he ordered into Paris to close down the National Assembly?
Probably yes. I mean, this would not be unusual in the context of the 18th century. Against popular protest, against food riots, against disorders of various kinds, troops were what you used, troops were what you had. You didn't have a massive police force, but you had a very big army, so you used troops. And people are quite, in that sense, used to the idea that they might confront armed soldiers if there were problems of one kind or another. It certainly wouldn't be extraordinary for anyone to expect troops to be used to contain a rebellious city or to deal with a political problem. Only the previous year, troops had been used to make sure that the parliaments were shut down in the spring of 1788, although of course they then reopened a few months later. But in reality, what that attempt to use troops really demonstrates is the lack of comprehension in the royal court about just how difficult that was going to be. They had no clear understanding of just how agitated Paris as a city was, of just how many people in the city were capable and prepared to resist. You know, they live in a political bubble where resistance has always been able to be crushed in the past, therefore resistance always will be able to be crushed, therefore you might as well try to crush it. On this occasion it turns out that their bubble will be burst by much larger social forces around them.
Yeah, thanks. Also, with reference to the 4th of August and the Great Fear, do you think the First and Second Estates were motivated solely by fear, or do you think they had a genuine desire for reform?
This is it's a very complicated episode, I think. A lot of different motives are involved from different groups, and in some senses a lot of different motives from within the same groups and possibly within the same people. The 4th of August itself, the great abolition of feudalism, was at one level just a very emotional experience for everyone involved. It was an escalation of commitment to the idea of national unity, to the idea of building a new national family. And pretty much all those who were there, present and observing the situation, agreed that people literally got emotionally carried away and ended up being prepared to commit a lot more than probably they themselves expected to this idea of national unity and civic equality. Saying that, there are all these other dimensions to the issue. At one level, there's a real concern, not just in the First and Second Estates, but in the old Third Estate deputies, that the country is sliding out of control, that the peasantry could become potentially dangerous, that in fact the counter-revolution might be stirring up the peasantry deliberately to prevent change, prevent a new constitution. So on the one hand, there is a real fear at the centre of what might be going on out in the countryside that the abolition of feudalism is supposed to deal with. On the other hand, there are lots of people amongst the Third Estate deputies, amongst the clergy, particularly from the lower clergy, the parish priests, and even amongst some quite distinguished aristocrats, that social justice is a real issue, that the poor are oppressed, that France could do more to make people more equal, to make them a national community. So there are a lot of different attitudes in play leading through to this dramatic moment. But it's also important to see the other side of this as well, because there are critical limitations to what the revolutionaries are prepared to do in 1789. They're walking a fine line between the idea of equality and the fact of actually trying to take away people's property and their income. So they take away the property of the church because it doesn't actually belong to an individual. They offer to give the clergy salaries instead. They abolish lots of honorific rights, lots of things that people find humiliating about the old regime. But they try to keep in practice, in place, the most costly payments that come to the seigneur, because they treat them as property. They treat them as those individuals' income, which they can't just abolish without compensation. And the same is true, for example, of all the privileged offices that people had bought in the old regime. Those are abolished, but people are paid very large sums of money in compensation. And the French actually end up doubling their national debt to compensate these already rich people for what's being taken away from them. And doubling that debt, of course, just adds to the difficulties of dealing with the underlying social and economic and political situation they're in. So there are fears, there are desires for reform, there are desires to walk a tightrope between some change and too much change, a tightrope which unfortunately they will fall off of.
So for the next few months, the Assembly busies itself writing a new constitution. And again, as with the Estates General, we know that that didn't go to plan either. Georgia, I think you have some questions about Louis' involvement in the failure of the constitution.
In your opinion, how significant was Louis' lack of support? For example, his refusal to sign into the law of abolition of feudalism or the Declaration of Rights to the revolution and the constitutional monarchy?
The role of Louis XVI, the way Louis XVI seems to think about the situation he's found himself in, is absolutely central to what's going on. The National Assembly is trying to build a constitutional monarchy. No one is imagining that they can have a republic. This is right off the political radar. Therefore, it's clearly desperately important, if you're going to have a constitutional monarchy, that you have a monarch at the heart of it, which is part of the process. Who is part of the process? Part of the system is accepting of what's going on. And this is very central to a lot of revolutionary events, right through to 1791, even into 1792, the idea that the king will be on people's side, that he will go along with them. You know, at the one level, it's what makes the idea of a constitutional monarchy possible in the first place. But you can also see that people have a real emotional attachment to the idea they can bring the king with them. Every time the king appears to be back on their side, there is huge rejoicing. There is huge rejoicing after the fall of the Bastille, when the king goes to Paris. There's huge rejoicing when he's brought to Paris again permanently in October, despite the fact that the king and the queen think they've basically been kidnapped at gunpoint. The Parisians are very happy to have them with them. They believe it guarantees a happy outcome from the process. There's joy and rejoicing at various other points, such as in February 1790, when again the king seems to commit himself to the constitutional process. So there's a huge desire to have him on board, to have him on their side, to be emotionally committed to that. But then what the king keeps doing is to waver, to backtrack, to give people cause for alarm over religious issues, over his relationship with the emigrated aristocrats, over his relationship with foreign powers, over what the queen might or might not be telling him. His failure to give a kind of consistent positive message to people creates an atmosphere of uncertainty into which suspicion, fear, anxiety creep, which is very significant in thinking about his future political fate and in some senses, the fate of the whole revolution.
And why did the revolutionaries feel it was necessary to force the swearing of the clerical oath, considering that they must have had some idea of the divided response it provoked?
Well, this is one of those episodes in the revolution which, in hindsight, it would have been a good idea to avoid, but at the time, there really was too much at stake. There was no plausible way for the National Assembly to back down from its attempt to take the clergy under control. They had nationalised the church property. They believed that they were nationally sovereign. They had the sovereign right to take the church under their control. And they knew that religion was a potentially very divisive issue. It had caused violence in southern France all through the previous year. It had allowed counter-revolutionaries, agents of the emigration, to find a popular constituency in the south, particularly to stir up Catholics against Protestants. So religion was something they couldn't afford to ignore. They couldn't afford to let these problems slip by. But any alternative to actually try to take firm control of the situation seemed like it would put the clergy back in the hands of the counter-revolution. So they felt they had to act, they had to crack down at those ideological levels, but also at a practical level. The clergy were fundamentally important to running the country. They were the avenue of welfare, education, a critical link in many areas in just communicating, particularly with a rural population that might not read French. It was a nationwide network which the state had used for centuries to help keep control of its population. So there was no way of kind of trying just to avoid the clergy or going round them. They had to be dealt with. And in the knowledge that many of the clergy didn't want to go along with these new relationships, the National Assembly decided they had to be forced to show their hand, because then, of course, you could root out the disloyal ones and bring in new loyal ones and make the clergy into a proper kind of religious civil service. But what, of course, they discovered when they tried to do this was it wasn't just 10%, 20% of the clergy. It was probably half of them. And in some areas of the country, it was almost all of them. And it created a huge reservoir of opposition, which is then available for the counter-revolution to plug into, and which in its own terms is already creating violent opposition to the revolutionary programme from early 1791 right onwards and right through into the Republic. So in hindsight it would have been better to find another way of doing things, but hindsight is a tool that wasn't available to them, and as far as they could see they really had no choice than to try and get a grip on this. It turned out it was too big a problem for them actually to control with the mechanisms they had available to them.
Okay, the constitution is almost ready to be signed. We've now got to the summer of 1791, and we come to the famous flight to Varennes. And I think, Gonselli, you're going to return to a question about Marie Antoinette.
Can you explain more about the influence of Marie Antoinette as a cause of continuing suspicion and discontent?
Yes, Queen Marie Antoinette is a fascinating figure of the revolution. Both at a practical level and in terms of the way she becomes a cultural icon and in a sense a myth. at a practical level, it's clear that she's continuing what she'd been trying to do in the 1780s, which was to become a more responsible person, to become a more helpful wife, to put aside her youthful frivolity. But as in the 1780s, that meant being a voice for her own political views, which were uncompromisingly counter-revolutionary. There's no evidence she ever considered any kind of long-term solution except somehow regaining control of France, turning France back into a proper monarchy where people did as they were told. And undoubtedly, through this period, 1798 to 1791, she is a voice for a hardline approach, talking in the king's ear about what they should do, what they need to do, and also conducting her own correspondence with her former friends and mentors in the Austrian court and increasingly with other people abroad about how foreign powers and the immigration and the court at home can work to bring about this overthrow of what she insists on seeing as just a rebellion rather than a real revolution. And while that's going on at a practical level, Marie Antoinette has also already become a myth. From 1789, with the huge expansion in the press, the liberation of the press from its pre-evolutionary censorship, one of the things this brings to light is a great deal of illegal pornographic material that the French police had successfully suppressed and prevented from being published in the 1770s and 1780s. A lot of this stuff was written and published almost deliberately in order to get paid off by the state for not circulating it. And a large quantity of it, for example, ends up in the Bastille and disappears in July 1789, goes into circulation. And a lot of these things are pornographic attacks on Marie Antoinette and her relationships with the king's brothers, with her own court favourites, and writing her up as a sexual and political monster. And with these older texts in circulation, they're amplified, they're illustrated. There's a huge popular appetite for learning bad things about this foreign woman who for a long time has been seen as a dangerous foreign agent in France and is now seen as an active threat to the revolution. So she's mythologized as someone to be afraid of, as well as, practically speaking, being someone who was advocating counter-revolution. And so suspicion of what she was really doing and imaginings about who she allegedly, mythically was all comes together and creates this kind of aura of evil around her, an idea that revolutionaries will have to confront her one day. They can only expect bad things to happen from her. And so this is one of the things that will contribute decisively to a series of political ruptures in the future as soon as radical groups decide that she really is just having too much influence, that something needs to be done, as is the case, for example, after the flight to Varennes.
And Sally?
Could Louis ever have survived the humiliation surrounding the flight to Varennes?
Well, it's clear the much of the political class wanted him to survive, if only as a figurehead, if only nominally guaranteeing this constitutional monarchy that they thought France had to have. The republican movement that does rise up after the flight to Varennes looks briefly influential, but is in fact very small in scale compared to a national willingness to accept the dominant narrative of Varennes, that it was a kidnapping and that the king could be persuaded to come back on board, accept the constitutional project. So there is there's a huge political willingness to let that happen, to let him survive the humiliation. But one of the points about that experience is that it was personally humiliating for him. As someone who'd been raised to be an absolute monarch, with Marie Antoinette egging him on to try and live up to that role, not to accept this humiliating, powerless position of constitutional monarchy. The shame and the humiliation of something like the flight to Varennes and the way it failed certainly acted on him. made him more open to perjuring himself. You know, when he accepts the constitution, he openly makes an oath, a formal, a solemn acceptance. And it's clear from the record that that was a lie, that it was perjury, that he had no intention of being a faithful constitutional monarch. So the humiliation of Varennes, in one sense, is not so much how the nation reacts to it, so much as how it reinforces the royal family's sense that none of this will ever work. Nothing good can come of this. They have to find a way out. No matter how much lying and cheating and manipulating they have to do, they have to get out. You know, it's not a question about the national response, although that's interesting. It turns a lot of people in the country at large against the monarchy, makes them more suspicious, but it probably makes the royal family really quite desperate to get out of the situation they found themselves in. But desperate enough to lie and cheat and manipulate and move the country towards a war that will turn out to be fatal to them.
So it's easy to see the constitutional monarchy in a sort of deterministic way that it was going to fail anyway, given all the problems that we've just been discussing. So I think, Louisa, you've got a question to ask, which is slightly counterfactual, but I think it's a very good question nevertheless.
If none of the problems that you mentioned in your notes had actually arisen, do you think the constitutional monarchy could ever have been viable in anything other than a theoretical situation?
Well, I mean, that certainly is very counterfactual, and it's important to recognise that. But it does identify one of the problems about what not just the way the royal family thought about the constitutional monarchy, but about the whole process of trying to construct it in the way it had been put together since 1789. It's not clear that the revolutionaries really grasped what they were trying to do, or in a sense that they were busily constructing a constitution that was self-contradictory, which is not to say it might not have worked. I mean, the sort of unwritten British constitution in the 18th century is riddled with contradictions, and nevertheless it works. It is fudged together. But one of the problems the French face is they weren't interested in having something that only worked in practice. They wanted to have a system, and they wanted to make it work systematically. But what they had in fact done in their constitution was put a huge contradiction right at the heart of it. They've almost explicitly said that the sovereign body is not the king. It is the single chamber legislative assembly that they put at the heart of it. That's where the national representation is. That's where laws come from. That embodies legitimacy, sovereignty. And that body has nothing to restrain it. There's no upper chamber, there's no Senate, there's no House of Lords. When the Legislative Assembly passes a law, it's the law. Unless, of course, the king vetoes it. You know, this is the one power they've left to the king, this completely negative opportunity to throw back a law for a period of years, which they clearly envisage as a last resort. But that's only part of the problem. There's the legislative process itself. There's also the process of government, which they've completely separated from the process of legislation. Whereas the Legislative Assembly embodies national sovereignty, the actual government is responsible to the king. He chooses the ministers. He oversees their activities. But they're not allowed to have anything to do with the elected representatives. Out of a fear that government would corrupt legislation, what the French construct is a situation where government and the political assembly don't really talk to each other, and so are capable of working in opposing directions. And what happens in practice when that comes into operation is that the kind of politicians that get elected to the Legislative Assembly want to influence the policy process. They want to be in charge in the way that they've seen the old National Assembly be in charge. And theoretically, they're not supposed to have that kind of overarching, wide-ranging role anymore. They're just supposed to make new laws. But of course, in terms of political practicalities, they are exactly able to influence public opinion, to, through the passage of new laws, attempt to force the government to do things it doesn't want to do. And then the king is faced with a situation only a couple of months after the start of this process, where he has to start throwing his veto around, or he'll be forced to attack people that he regards as his allies. The priests, the aristocrats, he is trying to defend them against the Legislative Assembly. So that's a consequence partly of the political situation, but also the very structure of that constitution itself. That's what it was designed to do, to keep those two parts of government and legislation apart. And you can imagine it could have been made to work under very, very different circumstances. But under anything like the circumstances of France at this time, it was going to lead to that kind of collision. And it's a fault that they had built in right from the start of their thinking about the process.
The emigres and the refractory priests, did they pose an actual threat? Or was it just kind of how they were presented by the Brissotins and the Jacobins?
Well, the emigres are definitely a real threat. I mean, the reason they have emigrated is to come back fighting against the revolutionary order. This is why the first wave of emigres leave immediately after the fall of the Bastille. This is why there's an accelerated wave of emigration after the flight to Varennes. It's perceived as the king giving a lead, the king attempting to emigrate himself, wanting to put himself outside France and act against France. And those emigres, the emigre leadership, lots of the young military officers that had gone abroad, they are plotting with enemy powers. They are planning to come back as an invading army. They are conspiring and plotting with their agents that remain inside France. So they are an active threat. Whether by themselves they would ever have been a sufficient threat to really harm France is a different question. But in the combination of circumstances, they were a threat that politicians in France couldn't avoid thinking and worrying about. And in that same context, the refractory clergy, this thousands and thousands of clergy who had explicitly refused to express any loyalty, they seem like the same kind of threat. They seem like, in some senses, an even more dangerous threat because of this hold the clergy are supposed to have over particularly their rural congregations. This belief that, that Catholicism can kind of seep into people's minds and suck loyalty out of them. And there's very much a sense amongst the revolutionary political class that France is now riddled with these Catholic fanatics who, given a chance, will drive them back to the Middle Ages, seek out new domination for the church against the revolutionary order. You know, and there is a strong tinge of paranoia to that view. There are many, many refractory priests who wanted to do nothing except be allowed to retire in peace. But there were many refractory priests who were quite prepared to burn the country down, to bring it back to Catholicism, and who were prepared to launch insurrections, to plot, to conspire. So there's a serious threat there. And the revolutionaries, because of the way they think about these kind of problems, escalate it to an even greater threat and then roll it into the one big threat of counter-revolution, which is what they've been inclined to do ever since 1789, to see all enemies as essentially aspects of the same enemy, to turn everything into this struggle between good and evil. It's very much part of the way they think about the world.
Georgia?
I was just wondering, the opening of the free press, which kind of coincided with this time, did it have a massive impact on the way that radical ideas spread amongst the people, do you think?
Definitely. This is one of the very interesting underlying cultural transformations that the revolution creates. The old regime is a regime of censorship. It's a regime where only a certain amount of information, only a certain kind of information, can circulate freely. But a lot of other information circulates illegally, secretly, both in written form and in oral form. And you find, for example, the Parisian police going to quite extraordinary lengths to track down people who write rude songs about the monarchy in the mid-18th century. And these rude songs are literally circulated from mouth to ear in the taverns of the capital, and sometimes scribbled down on pieces of paper. And historians can follow these way the police have tracked dozens of people trying to figure out who wrote the thing in the first place. And what the police can't see is that they all kind of collaborated on writing it. There was a kind of oral political culture that the police were trying to crush, but they couldn't. But the point of that in context of the revolution is that the revolution frees people to say out loud, publicly, all the suspicions of power and of what it might be doing that they've been forced to keep secret for decades. And those decades of censorship and repression have taught people to be suspicious, to be afraid of power, not to trust it. And so when that spills out into an open public sphere, it's suspicion and distrust and alarm and anxiety that spills out. And the Parisian press in particular is filled with anxiety, with hostility towards politicians, with rumours of émigré invasions and traitorous priests and speculation on the currency and all kinds of plots. So it's coming out of a pre-revolutionary culture where people had to voice these suspicions in secret, had to whisper them to each other. You know, it's the content gets carried over into a new environment where they're allowed to say these things openly. And then that just encourages people to be more suspicious, more anxious, more alarmist, because they're suddenly openly hearing an ever larger volume of political dispute and rumour and slander and accusation. So the public sphere that opens up during the revolution isn't a kind of genteel enlightenment space of discussion. It's a raging cloud of fear and anxiety and suspicion and accusation. And one of the difficulties that the political class faces is that many of those people in national politics are helping to produce that. That it's quite common to be both a political activist, or a politician, and a newspaper writer, to have your own newspaper. And, you know, sometimes literally to write it yourself, like Robespierre does in 1792, like Marat. Sometimes to get other people to write it for you, like Mirabeau does early in the revolution, and like Brissot does as well. But all of these people have their printed mouthpieces. And so that augments their tendency to compete with each other, to argue with each other. They commit a lot of their ideas to print, and then they're available to be used against them at a later stage, to be twisted, to be turned into accusations. It's a very, very hostile environment to try to publish opinions in. But the trouble is that everyone is trying to publish opinions, so they just amplify that hostility, amplify the suspicion. It's an important part of why so many things escalate, so many things go wrong, is this rapid circulation of things to be afraid of in the printed press and pamphlets.